This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. Okay, what I have for you is Michelle Holman of the Community Rights Lane County on an episode of FYI, talking about the Rights of Nature movement, and they need you to go to their website at the Community Rights Lane County and sign the petition to get watershed rights right now. So that's what this is about the struggle for rights of nature that we're having in the courts. You know, one thing about regulations that you guys have heard me say, regular listeners to this show, you know, in Egyptian times, when the house fell down that an architect had built, back then they built them as well as designed them, they would hang the architect in Egyptian times. And so that's why these regulations really end up working for these multinational corporations in the long run, is why I'm not really worried about the EPA being completely decimated right now. And I'm not saying don't regulate. What I'm saying is, you know, these guys end up paying a fine. The Horizon disaster, which I don't know about you, but I was in hysteria, just going nuts watching oil leak into the Gulf of Texas down there, the Gulf of Mexico down there in Texas on the Horizon oil spill. Several of their own people were killed, all because they wouldn't spend a little bit more money on a drill bit. And I know that's an oversimplification, but it just would have cost a little bit more money, a little less profits, and everything would have been safe. And so yeah, regulations, prohibition, it just gives organized crime purchase, you know. And again, I'm not saying don't regulate, but much more into taxing them out of existence and using that tax to clean up the mess that they've made. So what else? Oh, these trade deals with China. You know, you notice that China still has most favored nation status, even though we have 100% tariffs on them. So my prediction, and it's already happening, it's not much of a prediction, but they're just going to get better terms for multinational corporations. They're not going to get China to pay their workers more or do environmental regulations in China. No, they're going to make better terms for our multinational corporations to further continue raping people and the environment. So that's my take on that. Another story I always tell is I used to own 10 acres out here on Lorraine Highway in 1985, and in 94 I went up there and put up a lean-to and started living on my own property up there. And right away the neighbors complain, and it's complaint-driven. It's what's known as complaint-driven. If people complain that you're not following the building codes. And so you have to have septic and stuff out there to take care of your own waste, even though I'm one person on 10 acres. So I go down to the Lane County Building Department, and the guy, because I got cited, and the guy says, well, we don't want this to be like a third world country. Well, first he says, we don't allow homesteading here. This is America. We don't allow homesteading here. And I said, what are you talking about? The whole country was settled by homesteaders. And so then he backed down and said, well, we don't want someone creating a toxic mess that we have to clean up, and we don't want people living in like a third world country. So fast forward now to, we have a homeless problem with the population living like a third world country. Why can't we get some of these buildings in town that are going, Glenwood, there's 8 buildings that are just going in disrepair. And I went down to the city council and I said, you guys don't have a right. I mean, I'm not against land speculation, although that is really unnecessary, but if you're going to speculate with land waiting for the price to go up, that's fine, but you have to maintain your property. You can't just let go do whatever you want. And same with the trees, same with Weyerhaeuser. The larger piece of property you have, the more responsibility you have to the community. Just like in England with the all the moths were turning black from the smokestacks. And so, no, you cannot just pump crap into the air. And the trees, too. The forest is essential for all life on the planet. So you yes, you're going to have to follow some regulations, and you can't just do whatever you want with your property. So that's my spiel. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. Coming up, Michelle Holman. Support, please support the Community Rights Lane County and other legal organizations in Eugene and beyond.
Welcome to FYI, a public affairs program of KYAQ, Lincoln County's only community radio station. My guests today are Michelle Holman and Craig Kaufman. Michelle Holman is the chief petitioner of the Water Protection Initiative in Lane County. She's lived in Western Lane County's Coast Range in the Deadwood area for more than 30 years and has been active in the anti-herbicide struggle since the late 1970s. She is co-founder of Community Rights Lane County and the Oregon Community Rights Network. Craig Kaufman is an associate professor and director of graduate studies in political science at the University of Oregon and participating faculty in environmental studies. His research and teaching focus on environmental politics, ecological law, rights of nature, and sustainable development. His most recent book, with Pamela Martin, The Politics of Rights of Nature, Strategies for Building a More Sustainable Future, tells the story of how people around the world are creating new laws that recognize natural ecosystems as subjects with inherent rights and appealing to courts to protect those rights. Michelle and Craig are here to talk about how the Water Is Us campaign is moving forward, sponsored by the Oregon Community Rights Network. Michelle.
Thank you so much. This project that we are embarking upon in Lane County actually has roots since 2014. We were one of the chief communities that was trying to ban aerial spraying in Lane County forests and in Oregon forests. Lincoln County is the county that actually passed a spray ban, and with a margin that showed that the majority of Lincoln County communities didn't want to be sprayed. As soon as they passed it, they were sued by timber interests. And 2 years down the road, the Oregon Supreme Court sided with the timber interests. We did the same thing in Lane County in 2014. We wrote our spray ban. We were never, ever on the ballot. We took it to the Supreme Court on the grounds that we were being denied ballot access. The Oregon Supreme Court sided with the timber interests, and we never got on the ballot. So we put the spray ban to bed, and we birthed the Lane County Watersheds Bill of Rights, which is another way to protect our waters and to stop spraying. And we have filed in the county. We were just waiting for the okay. We were told that we satisfied all the constitutional hurdles and that our ballot title was indeed accepted. And then in the 11th hour, we found out that we had been challenged by the same interests who stopped us with our spray ban. And so now we are waiting for a court process to ensue. We have intervened on behalf of what we believe is a good ballot title. This could take 2 to 3 months, but as soon as this is put to bed, we will be on the streets collecting signatures, getting the Lane County Watershed Bill of Rights initiative onto the ballot. And we'll be gathering signatures. We're very excited about protecting Lane County's waters. We find it to be a unifying cry across the political spectrum. People want clean water.
Indeed. And I'm sure you know about the activity here in Lincoln County and ballot measure 177 that was passed by Lincoln County voters in 2017, which went through the same kinds of legal challenges that you're talking about, and ultimately was overruled by a Lincoln County Circuit Court judge, and then went to the Court of Appeals. And I I'm not sure what the status of that case is at this point. Are you familiar with that?
Yep. The Supreme Court ruled against the Lincoln County voters.
So that's the end. That's the end of it at this point, then.
That's the end of that. You know, this is just all object lessons in how that there is no justice in the courts. The system doesn't protect the people. At the basis of our work is exposing and challenging unjust law and making people aware that the system doesn't work for us, and it won't. It's going to take us, we the people, demanding change. We don't look to our legislators. We don't think we're going to vote our way out of the mess we're in. We're going to have to insert ourselves into the mess as the residents of where we live. It's local action. And as some people like to say, democracy is all local. Politics are all local. So we're doing our best here. And we envision more communities coming online to defend their watersheds. So we're remaining positive and excited about the chance to talk to people one-on-one and not begging elected officials, not begging corporations to behave themselves. We don't believe that that's a good use of time.
Right. So when these kinds of issues come before state legislatures, and I guess specifically the Oregon state legislature, who are the players, generally speaking, that are in opposition to your efforts?
Well, in opposition to our efforts, it can really run the gamut, but mostly you're going to see the timber interests that are very nervous about people like us doing what we do. In fact, in the challenge to our ballot title, they kind of made our argument for us. They said, oh, these people think government isn't doing their job. Yeah, that's exactly what we're saying. We do not believe we're being served by the regulations as they are. And yes, there are some good legislators. I'm not going to say that wholesale they are all corrupt, but mostly you see legislators getting their funds for their reelection campaigns from these interests. So they kind of have to behave themselves, and they do serve and protect the corporate status quo. But we also have some progressive, quote unquote, progressive environmental organizations that don't like our tactic either. So, you know, we have a kind of a laser focus on empowering people to protect the places in which they live.
Right. So that's interesting. Are there what kind of groups that are more in line with protection of the environment? What groups object to your methods?
Well, I'm not going to name names.
Okay.
But there are,
it can be general.
In general, kind of your traditional environmental groups, all very well-meaning, but sort of using the tactics that we've been using for 40, 50 years since an environmental movement was created in response to a degrading environment. And 40, 50 years hence, we're not really in any better situation. Environmental protection laws don't go far enough. And we think that basically what we need to do is insert ourselves as the people who live in the communities to say, we see that things are worse than they were. And so let's change that. Let's grow protections for nature.
Yeah. So the groups you're talking about, as I understand it, probably use a lobbying approach a lot more than your approach, which is very much a bottom-up grassroots approach.
Right. You got it.
I can speak a little bit more
yes,
to this.
Please.
If you like, just general. I'll talk not specifically necessarily about sort of the Lane County, but this is a phenomenon that exists sort of broadly across the country, which is that there has been a split in the environmental movement in terms of approach going back to the 60s and 70s between what are often called sort of mainstream environmental groups. And these are like the, you know, organizations like the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, and those kinds of groups that have chosen to take a tactic of working within the system, so to speak, to try to, you know, their argument, to be fair, is that ultimately we're going to need to get corporations and other large polluters to change their behaviors. And, you know, they just simply believe that you're more likely to get that if you negotiate with them and work within the system and try to get compromised legislation. The problem is, as Michelle's noted, is that's focused, that produces legislation that focuses on mitigation, which is to say you might get corporations to say, you know, I'll try to restrain myself a bit. And so my pollution or consumption may be a bit less than otherwise it would be if we had, you know, no constraints. But the nature of exponential growth on which our economy is based means that over time, the damage to ecosystems continues to grow exponentially, even if, you know, even if any individual entity is sort of mitigating their behavior a little bit. And so the other side of the split, you know, have been more sort of direct action groups that criticize the, you know, the mainstream approach of trying to work within the system, you know, and they say things like Michelle's been saying, which is the problem is that the laws are sort of not giving us the results that we want or need. And so therefore we need different laws. And, yes, we want corporations to change their behavior, but you're essentially being co-opted when you work within the system because the system is essentially controlled by these interests, and therefore we need to fundamentally change the system through new laws and rules. And they tend to adopt tactics like, you know, Community Rights Lane County, which is direct action and grassroots mobilization and things like that. So this has been a common feature of environmentalism in the United States for the last 50 years.
We actually like to call this, thank you, Craig, for that. This is literally civil disobedience through lawmaking. We see the law is unjust. We will forward a just law in its place and give the voters the right to vote to protect further than any environmental law is going to. Environmental laws actually legalize allowable amounts of destruction.
Yeah. So that sort of brings to mind Oregon's Forest Practices Act. I seem to recall amid great fanfare, a lot of different organizations announcing what a triumph it was, a collaboration between environmentalists and corporate interests to produce, you know, I guess, revisions to the Forest Practices Act. I'm guessing you have a different view of that.
Absolutely. I mean, actually, many of us feel we were thrown under the bus by these well-meaning traditional environmental groups. Yeah, you can't negotiate protection. You know, you're either going to protect or you're not going to protect. And for some of us, when we talk about the allowable parts per million that you can destroy, that's not only laughable, but it's offensive. So we don't want to play that game. We don't feel the earth has the time to play that game. We're not looking for incremental over time change, although we recognize that we aren't going to get what we want today. But we are, that's our guiding principle, is that a little is not enough. We really have to acknowledge that the systems are failing us, the people, and the earth that we rely upon.
Yeah. So just to back up just a little bit and talk about what's going on that is such a danger to our watersheds, it is essentially the continued use of aerial spraying. Am I right in that?
Well, that's just one, but yes, it's a big one. I mean, it's a big one because Lane County is forested, highly forested, from right. The McKenzie up Oak Ridge all the way to the Coast Range out here where I live. Aerial herbicide sprays have been banned in many countries across the globe. Right here, it's still a standard operating procedure. It accompanies clear-cut logging, which is another regardless of if you spray or you don't spray, clear cutting is a dinosaur that needs to disappear. I mean, it's on its way out, we believe. But that said, there's industrial pollution of our waters in the larger cities. In Lane County, right now, our biggest enemy is really the timber industry, and they're digging in their heels, and so are we.
Okay, and it really is particularly well. I'm familiar with the activities in Lincoln County. I have interviewed Carol Van Strom, mm-hmm. who wrote a great book about her efforts in the Five Rivers area to stop the aerial spraying, and she did finally, I think, after a 10-year battle, get the federal government to stop spraying federal lands, but private timber owners are still using aerial spraying, as I understand it.
True
and
enough.
that was what Measure 177 was meant to stop, and it had widespread support in Lincoln County. It was a ballot initiative that was passed, was actually in effect for over 2 years, I think. And I'll tell you something. When I go out to visit my friends who live in the forest, in the last year, I have noted so much more wildlife there. The rabbit and the bird population seems to have just exploded. And my theory is that in those 2 years, they were living in an actually healthy environment, which allowed them to prosper.
And the industry did not succumb. They didn't, you know, the sky did not fall.
Right.
So it was really an object lesson in, yes, we can do this a different way.
Yeah. So, Craig, you have been involved in the rights of nature movement for a very long time. And can you just give us a little background on sort of the genesis of that movement and how you feel it's going at this point?
Yeah. So one of the things, I should say, I first became aware of it because I happened to be working in Ecuador back in the mid-2000s on local watershed management projects. And so lived through the experience through which, Ecuador came to recognize rights of nature in its constitution. And it did so because it was able to do so because there was a group of different interests that differed in a lot of ways, but they all shared a common interest in trying to adopt a different approach to what we might think of as development, different than the traditional neoliberal approach of just extractivism and generating lots of wealth for the sake of increasing consumption. And at first, I thought that was just a uniquely interesting sort of Ecuadorian story. But then I became aware of a number of other efforts that were happening in Bolivia. And then, of course, I came back to, in 2012, I came to the University of Oregon and soon got visited. A member of Community Rights Lane County, I forget who it was, showed up in my office one day, just, hey, I heard you know about rights of nature. And then I heard about stuff that was happening in New Zealand and went out there to study what was happening. And at first, I thought that this was a diffusion story, meaning that there was some genesis of it in a single place, and then people were sort of spreading this idea, and promoting it around through transnational networks of people. But one of the things that I found is that, and this is a long way of answering your question, to say, I don't think it's one movement. It is many, many, many different movements all around the globe, because one of the things that I found in my research is that various rights of nature movements are cropping up around the country at the same time, but in working in parallel. And they're doing so, I believe, because they're all feeling, around the world, you have communities that are feeling common pressures that are stemming from just the global changes we have in terms of the intensity of extractive industries, which creates pressures on communities and it's increasing conflicts. The story is really common around the globe, and communities are struggling to find a way to push back. And they're finding that in many cases, the legal systems as they are at the time aren't helping them. And so they're looking for new solutions and new laws that will help them with, you know, take care of the environments that they live in. And they're motivated by this because of their concern for their families, right? And they recognize, they feel, they understand that their well-being as people is dependent on the well-being of the ecosystems where they live. And these are getting legally and culturally framed and structured different ways in different societies, as you might expect. In some places, they're being framed as rights of nature, in places where, you know, we signal what we value by giving them rights. But in other places, they're taking different kinds of cultural framings. There are various indigenous models. There's places in Africa where they frame it in terms of protecting sacred natural sites. But there are these common underlying principles of recognizing that humans are embedded in the ecosystems that provide the conditions necessary for life. And so we have to stop treating, elements of nature as if they're just stocks of resources that can be used and manipulated sort of independently, as if that's not going to affect the health of the overall system. And instead, they're recognizing that we need to take an ecosystem level approach to management, recognizing that all the parts are interconnected through interdependent reciprocal relationships. And so that's why you've got to really do this at an ecosystem level and not focus on just one resource or one animal species or what have you. This has been growing exponentially over the last 15 years. And of course, as these different examples have grown and matured, they get national and international attention. And so then you do have sort of that. I think that's helped spur this exponential growth. And what I think of as these local experiments with new legal approaches. And I run something called the Eco Jurisprudence Monitor, which tries to track these around the world. And there are about 500 legal provisions around the world that include various, you know, common principles about ecological jurisprudence. That is to say, focusing on protecting the functioning of ecosystem cycles that produce the conditions necessary for life. 339 of those are framed as rights of nature. So there have been 339 attempts to adopt legal provisions recognizing rights of nature across the world. 219 of those have been approved. So roughly 2/3 of the time when you try it, it gets adopted and approved. I'll point out that in the United States, of course, there are a lot of these things because, again, in our federal system, we're forced to do this at the, you know, since the national legislature is effectively closed for new rulemaking, particularly on the environment, the strategy is what, you know, Michelle and others are doing, which is you take it to the, bypass the legislators and take it to the people through ballot initiatives. And there are 134 of these kinds of initiatives, local initiatives across the US. And so far, 70 of them have been adopted. So again,
wow, that's great. So it roughly really is a growing movement.
So to give you a sense of the growth between 2006 and like the first five, 2012, it doubled in size, and then it doubled in size again from 2011 to 2016, and then it doubled in size again from 2016 to 2022. So I mean, it's doubling about every 5 years, the number of these initiatives.
Here in Oregon, the problem with the ballot measures that have been proposed, the one that you're pursuing now in Lane County, is it sort of hits a brick wall over the state preemption, so-called state preemption laws.
Yes, absolutely. We're coming for the state preemption. That's on our radar. Absolutely. We're building critical mass locally. You cannot launch a statewide campaign until you have enough local buy-in. But we have our eye on that. And as a matter of fact, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, many of us in the community rights movement met in Colorado and wrote the 28th amendment to the federal constitution that gives the residents the right to self-government, which says we can write and pass laws that protect our health, safety, and welfare. So, you know, we're starting locally. We will do the same thing once we can get enough buy-in from communities across Oregon. We are coming for state preemption. We need to have a constitutional amendment in our state that says that we have the right to self-government, that we have the right to protect ourselves. And we actually have a notion. It's not a notion. It is in every state constitution across the U.S. Article 1, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution says that the people are the sovereign, that all power is inherent in the people, and that we have the right to alter or abolish the government as we see fit. So we have the empowerment, we just have not been using it. And it's, to me, it's a huge disrespect. Also, it's an educational campaign. We need to let Oregonians know that we do have this power and we need to use it. And we're fortunate, we have the initiative system in Oregon. It's the way the people legislate. If we don't use it, we're gonna lose it. And they do, the corporate overlords have done their darndest to throw obstacles in our path when it comes to using the initiative system. I think early on, they probably thought we wouldn't really do it. And the people have some feistiness within us, and we are using it, and we will continue to use it. It is how we change law. Yes, we will come. We do know we will hit walls. That can't stop us. Those walls are meant to come down.
Okay. So we are getting short on time. We've only got 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to be sure that you talk about the online event you're having on February 22nd. Can you give us a little outline of that?
Yeah, well, that's going to be Craig. We'll be speaking. We have a panel of Craig Kaufman, myself, and Kunu Berchum, who is also a chief petitioner of the Protect Lane County Watersheds Bill of Rights. And we're going to be just having a roundtable discussion about water is life, and that we all live downstream. We all live in a watershed. It's going to be a really great conversation. It's February 22nd at 6 p.m. Am I correct, Craig?
Yep.
Yes.
That's what it says here in Minute. And also, it's a Zoom event. And it says you can send, the public can send requests for a link to info@orcrn.org.
Thank you so much.
Yes. So we've got about 2 minutes left. So I will give each of you a minute for any closing remarks. I'm sorry we've run out of time. This has been a fascinating discussion. But anyway, you've got your 2 minutes.
Go for it, Craig.
Okay. I guess the last thing I will just say is I think it's important for everybody to recognize and remember that, you know, rights of nature laws, like the ones being proposed, are not the end in and of themselves. They're a tool to try to achieve the end goal, which is to try to get people to change their understanding of their relationship to the natural world away from one where, you know, the way we've been trained to see ourselves as separate and apart from nature, and therefore nature is just a collection of resources for us to consume, to try to change that to a recognition that we are part of nature, and we're part of the ecosystems where we live, and our health and well-being is dependent on the health and well-being of the ecosystems that produce the conditions for life and their ability to continue to generate those conditions.
Okay. Michelle?
Yeah, well, locally, we're just going to say that existing law doesn't adequately protect our county's waters. And in fact, it authorizes further degradation through harmful corporate activities. So our Protect Lane County Watersheds Initiative will give private citizens, as well as local government, the tools we need to enforce the provisions of a more broad-based protective law. We are looking for all kinds of support on the ground, You do not have to live in Lane County. In fact, one of the beautiful things about community rights is that we go to each sister organization chapter and we help each other. So you don't have to live in the county. You don't have to be 18. You just have to be a body that wants to collect signatures. Come to communityrightslanecounty.org or protectlanecountywatersheds.org, and we will hook you up.
Okay. Thank you very much. Michelle Holman of the Oregon Community Rights Network and Professor Craig Kaufman, active environmental politics and ecological law. Thank you for coming to KYAQ to help our listeners better understand this important issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. brought to you by Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Built on the site where an actual ancient rainforest once stood, see a full-scale replica of a Douglas fir tree. See pictures of trees larger in diameter than a man is tall. Trout and salmon that once choked the rivers of the Northwest will sing to you in our Chamber of Taxidermy. Hear the disaffected sounds of Feller Buncher and his Bunch of Fellers, an all-ex-logger band, in our simulated wood amphitheater. Take the Oregon Desert Highway to the clear-cut road exit, turn right at the stump in the road, and you're at Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Free parking, kids a buck and a half, closed during summer months due to melting asphalt, giant locusts, and methyl ethyl hydroxy colchicine slag emissions.